It's another episode of Pittsburgh Pop. Tim Benz and Rob Owen. Rob from TV Talk and TV Q&A here at Trib Live. Of course, you can read me daily on the sports side, Breakfast with Benz. Rob, I got done with the second half of the Barbenheimer double dip yesterday. I saw Oppenheimer with my stepson. 3:50 matinee in McCandless. It started at 4:15, and I didn't get out of there until 6:55.
Yeah, it's about a 3-hour, 20-minute, 30-minute movie, something like that.
They could have saved a lot of time, I think, at the beginning with all the flashback sequences. I don't know what you felt about it, but I thought they time-hopped a little too much in the beginning.
It was a little confusing in the beginning as to where you were. By the end, it made sense, but I agree. At the start, I was a little bit unsure when things were taking place.
The other thing that was confusing was all the names of the scientists. There were so many other scientists besides Oppenheimer and Einstein. Like, those two I could follow.
Right.
Heisenberg, I guess, because of Breaking Bad.
Right,
he was only
right.
in one scene until the very end, and then he came back, I guess. But, you know, those other guys, I found myself getting lost in the dialogue and the writing sometimes because they'd reference another scientist by last name. I'm like, well, wait a minute. Is this the guy that doesn't like him? Or is this the guy
right.
that kind of likes him? Or is this the guy that the military hired? What about the guy from England? Like, I was doing this in my head every time another one of those scientists was referenced, which gave me a whole new appreciation for screenwriters and directors who come up with composite characters. I'm like, ah, that's why they do that in biopics. Now I understand.
Yeah, I would say that I was pretty well tracking with who was who till about 3/4 of the way through. And then when we got to sort of the hearings part, and then you didn't, and they would mention a character and they didn't immediately show you that character, that was when I started to be like, okay, who is that?
Yeah, everybody needed name tags. I wanted everybody to have name tags or
name
little
tags
bubbles over their heads. Yes. It feels like something Quentin Tarantino might do, not Christopher Nolan, but I thought the middle part of the movie was great. Like, when they stopped time hopping and once they got to Los Alamos, I thought it was really good through the bomb exploding, you know, through the scene where he addresses everybody after they bomb Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Sorry, spoiler alert. Once they got through all of that, that was good. And then the end, how'd you feel about the ending? Let me ask you, how'd you feel about the ending?
So I have heard people say that they think it should have ended with him addressing the Los Alamos people, but I really liked the ending. The fact that we went forward in time and dealt with the aftermath and his sort of mixed feelings about being involved in the whole thing. I mean, he vacillated quite a lot, which, you know, that is human. People don't always stick to their same thoughts on something. And I really liked the last part, but I'm also a sucker for courtroom drama, which is sort of what it turned into. But I thought you needed that to get the whole picture. Because
you needed that last conversation with him and Einstein and get to what they talked about.
Yes. Because it did sort of show his ambivalence in the end as to whether what he had done was the right thing or not.
It did. The only thing I didn't like about it, Rob, was, you know, like, if, and my stepson and I were talking about this in the way of the theater, he very much said what you said, and he can kind of view it through the lens of just being about the story of Oppenheimer. But to me, especially since it's Christopher Nolan, and I always assume that these really big time star Hollywood directors and screenwriters are trying to make some bigger statement about what their film is. That whole thing about the world being on fire, that line he talks about where we were worried that we would start a chain reaction that would blow up the earth. And for that to sit out there and they have that whole montage that they went back to of the chain reaction that was going to melt the world. I wondered if what they were getting at was kind of regret that the bomb was ever sent to Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the first place, and maybe we'd be in a better spot if none of this had ever happened. But I do think we did learn from what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, if nothing else, by way of we haven't shot another one off since then. You know, like, if you want to do the whole butterfly effect, you got to change a lot of things about world history since that occurred.
I guess my thinking is that he was raising questions, he was not answering questions, and you know, I think that that is something that that is useful, but not always appreciated by an audience. I think the idea is to get you thinking, excuse me, thinking about it and sort of come to your own conclusion as to whether that was the right thing to do or not.
I thought it was effectively done. I just disagreed with the message, if that was in fact the message he was trying to get across. That's all. I thought the movie making element, the way he delivered the point he was trying to make, the way I interpret it anyway, I thought he executed it well. I just kind of disagreed with the message. You know, I get it. It was a horrible thing that happened, but there is some merit to us not essentially trying to do Vietnam 25 years earlier against the country that could have made it even worse on us and having even more casualties, you know, and more American lives dying over there. Like they did it for a reason. And the reason I do think made sense in the end, if you wanted to end the war.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Oppenheimer makes that clear, that that was initially certainly his impetus for being involved in the project. And I don't know. I don't think that it was Nolan saying this was wrong. I think it was Nolan saying it's an open question. Discuss amongst yourselves.
Yeah. Well, I do like a movie that you can at least talk about amongst yourselves, as we did on the way back from McCandless to Bellevue in the North Side. But so that was my back half of Barbenheimer. I do think that you'll see Cillian Murphy and definitely Margot Robbie win each Oscar. I think they should. I think they were that good, both of them in the lead roles.
Yeah, I certainly think they'll both be nominated, and we'll see. And I think Oppenheimer will win Best Picture for sure, but we'll see.
Yeah, the middle chunk of it was really good. Matt Damon was surprisingly good.
I really liked him quite a lot.
I kind of thought he was just a support character, and he was. He was a support character. I don't like too much of it. You talked about Robert Downey being really good. He was excellent as the bad guy.
He was so good.
As sort of the antagonist of the whole thing. I thought he was excellent. But Matt Damon, his character was, I think he made it more important to the movie, more memorable to the movie as the general.
Yeah, and there were a lot of really strong supporting actors in there, people that I've seen in things. David Krumholtz as the other scientist who's kind of most in Oppenheimer's corner. He's an actor who's been around a long time. Rami Malek had a role that was small but pivotal in the end.
Yeah, I kind of didn't get him. Like, if they were going to spend more time on something and less on something else, that Chicago faction, at least, because he's in like two scenes barely before his climactic scene, and he doesn't even speak really in one of them. You're like, okay, he's going to be important, because they could have gotten any schlub to play him. Something's going to happen with that guy. Like, I know him from the Freddie Mercury role. He's got to be important. They wouldn't have cast him to do nothing. So it was a little weird. Like, okay, when's Rami Malek going to make his appearance here? How far into this movie are we?
Yeah, no, but I appreciated that there were so many high profile actors who came to play in smaller parts. I mean, Kenneth Branagh only had a couple scenes. I very much enjoyed that film, and I'm glad it exists. There aren't a lot of movies like that, kind of made for adults, that make you think. That's not something that we get all that often anymore. So I appreciate it for that, if nothing else.
Well, Rob, what will film and TV critics remember more in the decades to come, Oppenheimer or the Bill Cowher documentary?
I'm pretty sure it'll be Oppenheimer.
I'm not kidding. There is a Bill Cowher documentary that's coming out, right? It's going to be on what used to be Epix.
Epix, which is now MGM Plus, which is both a linear channel in some cable packages, but also a streaming channel. Such that it is. But yes, their docuseries NFL Icons comes back for a third season, and it's four parts, and it will profile Jim Brown, Charles Woodson, Mike Singletary, and Bill Cowher. The season premieres October 21st, and the Cowher episode is the third one to air, so that'll be on November 4th.
Yeah, and that's a pretty good class that he's with. And I think Rich Eisen is narrating all of them. Did I see that correctly?
I think so. Yes. Yes. Yep.
What's going on with your new Star Trek series that you like so much?
So Star Trek Strange New Worlds, they did a musical episode 2 weeks ago, and then they had their season finale last week. And it's just, it is you know, when Star Trek came back in the streaming era with Star Trek Discovery, they very much were trying to make it different. And at first, that seemed like an okay thing to do. All right, we're going to sort of modernize our storytelling. But the thing that really hit was when they introduced Captain Pike, who's a character we saw in the original series, and Spock and Number One, played by Rebecca Romijn. And those characters, they sparked when they were in Discovery. And so fans were clamoring for a series with them, and ultimately Paramount gave it to them. And it turned out to be the best thing they could have done, because Strange New Worlds sort of harkens back to the original Star Trek. Yes, there are some ongoing character arcs throughout the season, but each episode has a definitive beginning, middle, and end mission to it. And, you know, in an era where everything is serialized, there's something to be said for good episodic television writing. And I think Strange New Worlds has done a very good job of that through its two seasons. I came late to it. I watched it originally, liked it, just didn't stick with it, sort of had a sour taste from where Discovery had gone. But I caught up on it in time for the musical episode. The musical was fun. It was very similar to the Buffy musical episode from way back when, in terms of the type of music. But then the season finale was a great cliffhanger. And the thing that I like about Strange New Worlds so much more than Discovery is Discovery, you have characters coming in and out here, there, and everywhere. You don't get that crew as family feeling. And on Strange New Worlds, you get that 100%. So I will be eagerly awaiting season three whenever they can get a chance to write it and film it after these strikes are done.
Last thing, and this is going to be big in my household, I can tell you that, because Jamie is a big fan of this show. Only Murders in the Building is back, right?
It is. It is back for its third season. We sort of got a hint of what season three would be at the very end of season two, where we see Paul Rudd as an actor in Oliver, that's the Martin Short character's Broadway show, drop dead on stage. There's a bit of a twist to that in the first episode, but suffice it to say, there's another murder. It does end up being in the building. And so then they're off to the races investigating it. I've seen the first, I think, 8 episodes of the new season. As a story, I don't know that it moves as quickly as I would like it to. We also don't see our main three protagonists, Martin Short, Steve Martin, and Selena Gomez, together as much as we would like. There's a bit of a falling out there, which I think hurts the show to some degree. Falling out among their characters. Not a big one, but just enough that you don't see them together as much. But what does work really well is Meryl Streep. She plays one of the actresses in Oliver's play, which he turns into a musical. And when he turns it into a musical, they actually show you some of the songs from the musical. And there's a beautiful one that Meryl Streep sings. It's sort of a lullaby. The story of the musical itself is kind of crazy. It's like somebody winds up dead in a lighthouse during a hurricane, and the only other person in the room is an infant, or possibly triplets. I don't know. It was a little confusing, but the song is really good. And the reason it's really good is because it's written by Sarah Bareilles, Benj Pask, and Paul, the guys who did Greatest Showman music. And so her lullaby, really listening to it, brings to mind some of the songs from Greatest Showman. So even though I'm not sure they had enough story to fill all their episodes this season, the musical piece, the Meryl Streep of it, she's very good, of course, is it's worth watching for that. And they're releasing some of the music as digital downloads, including the Meryl Streep lullaby song that'll be out on Wednesday of this week.
What do you have going on in TV Talk and TV Q&A?
So TV Talk, going to look at sort of the impact of the strike, the Summer of Suits, even though it's a show that's been off the air for a bunch of years now, and the return of Babylon 5 as a direct-to-DVD animated film. And then in TV Q&A, we have a question about designers on HGTV shows, and why don't they put TVs in the rooms that they design?
Wait, you said you were going to do this one before. Do we hold back on this one? Do we have
yeah,
to table
it,
that?
Was
it too
was
complicated? It was probably too complicated of a topic. You needed some more time to suss it out.
No, a more timely question came up, so it got replaced. So that's
right,
what happened there.
Definite cliffhanger. I've been waiting to hear about this one for a long time.
I'm sure.
All right. As far as we go on Breakfast with Bands, of course, full recaps throughout the course of the week on the Steelers' first preseason game and lead you into the Buffalo game on Saturday of this upcoming week as they get their home debut for the preseason at Acrisure Stadium. The day after Guns N' Roses, I will be going to Guns N' Roses so I can review that as well during our next Pittsburgh Pop podcast, which is coming your way here next Monday at Trib Live.